The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Jemima Kish. On the show this week, Alex Krotowski muses on the forgotten technology of CB radios, and
you've got a tap that delivers the hot water and then dries your hands, so you can stand there and do your washing and your drying over the sink in one.
Charles Arthur meets the icon of British technology and design, James Dyson, to discuss his latest product, the Airblade Tap. You heard correctly, that's the Airblade Tap. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. If you're still wondering what exactly an Airblade Tap is, settle down and rest your curiosity by listening to The Guardian's technology editor, Charles Arthur. He met with the designer and tech entrepreneur James Dyson, the man behind a striking array of innovative vacuum cleaners, cold air fans, and those hand dryers that do spooky things to your hands.
So I'm here with James Dyson, who has his new products, including improved hand dryers at the Airblade and also a tap, which includes an Airblade. James, just explain to me, what is special about these new devices?
Well, you've got a tap that delivers the hot water and then dries your hands. So you can stand there and do your washing and your drying over the sink in one. You know, no dripping and queuing for the dryer and all that sort of thing. So that's a complete revolution in washing and hand drying over the sink. So that's one of our new products. And the other one is a hand dryer that goes on the wall. It's incredibly slim. So it's not much bigger than a book. And that dries your hands in 10 to 12 seconds, very, very quickly.
So many people will have seen the Airblade, which has high-speed air coming out. It's not warmed air, so it's not like the air blowers that we might be used to in other places. What sort of difference is there in power consumption between yours and the hot air blowers, and what sort of benefits might that bring?
Well, if you we scrape the water off, mechanically, if you like, not literally, because it's not actually touching the skin.
How fast is the air going to do that?
The air comes out of the blades at about 450 miles an hour. And it forms a blade that you can see it ripple across your skin as it goes across your hands, scraping the water off, so no heat's needed. So we use 1/6 of the electricity of a hot air hand dryer. And of course it's much faster because you're not having to boil the water off your hands, and it does less damage to your skin. So it's approved by the Skin Foundation. So it's a very much better hand dryer to use. It's very hygienic. All the air passes through a HEPA filter.
Sorry, what's a HEPA filter?
A HEPA filter filters out any impurities in the air. They're used in, and it's called a high efficiency particulate arrester. So it stops very, very, very small particles. So the air that's being blown out of the blades is pure air.
You've built up a lot of anticipation around this launch. You've had a sort of covering over the front of your office in London saying, watch what's going to be next. For people who've been used to the sort of innovations that you've come up with, such as the wheelbarrow, which had a ball rather than a wheel so that it didn't wobble about in the same way, or for your cyclone vacuums, they might think, well, this is a bit of a sort of a variation on a theme, that you had the Airblade, now you've sort of added it to a tap. What's your response there?
Oh, well, those of us who go into public washrooms go and wash our hands at a sink, and then we carry our dripping hands over to a hand dryer and probably join a queue to use the hand dryer and then use the hand dryer. Now you don't have to do that. You go to the sink, you wash your hands and dry your hands under a beautiful-looking tap very, very quickly, and out you go. So for those of us who use public washrooms, this is a revolution.
And what sort of applications could the motor in it? Because you have a motor which runs at 100,000 RPM, which is three times faster than any previous motor has worked. Are there other applications for it? What sort of things will you do with it?
It's got lots of applications, which I'd love to tell you about, but I can't because we're busy developing those products. But motors are at the heart of so many products, and if you can make them more efficient electrically and make them smaller and lighter, you create so many opportunities, and that's what we're going for.
So to guess at the next Dyson product, we should look for something that needs a motor and think of that.
Yes, that would be quite a good idea, but I'm not going to tell you.
James Dyson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And to see the Airblade Tap in all its video glory, go to guardian.co.uk/technology. Now for a roundup of this week's technology news with Jason Phipps.
It was announced this week that personal computer maker Dell is selling itself for $24.4 billion to its founder Michael Dell and a group of investors including Microsoft and Silver Lake Partners. The agreement ends Dell's near 25-year history as a public listed company and is the biggest deal of its kind since the 2007 credit crunch. Dell, which generates 70% of its sales and more than half of its profits from PCs, aims to transform itself from a PC maker to an IBM-style information technology business. The company has been on a spending spree in recent years, investing $12 billion into security, storage, software, cloud and data center-related companies. Mr. Dell said, "Dell has made solid progress executing this strategy over the past 4 years, but we recognise that it will still take more time, investment and patience, and I believe our efforts will be better supported with Silver Lake in our shared vision." Technology-focused private equity firm Silver Lake are contributing cash to the deal, whereas Microsoft will offer a $2 billion loan. And more news of Microsoft. Its newest tablet offering, the Surface Pro, has been in the news this week after receiving mixed reviews from critics. The Surface Pro is thicker, heavier, and several hundred pounds more expensive than its predecessor and will be available in 64 and 128GB editions. The prices start steep, with the most basic version being available for around $899, that's £535. And the touch cover keyboard, which critics are calling a necessity, will cost an extra $120. The latest model runs on the Intel i5 chip with Microsoft's new operating software, Windows 8, improving on last year's Surface RT, which ran on an ARM Holdings PLC design chip, which was not compatible with older Microsoft programs. The device's battery life has come under most scrutiny, with many claiming that its four-hour life is impractical and frustrating, with others stating that it's simply too big and bulky for a supposed mobile piece of technology. The company claim, however, that the device is the first to bring a full operating system to the tablet without compromising on quality. Consumers in the US and Canada will be able to make their own minds up when the Surface Pro hits the stores on the 9th of February. Microsoft has yet to comment on a European release date. A new survey published by the US Pew Research Center has claimed that two-thirds of Facebook users have taken a voluntary break from the site for several weeks or more, citing reasons ranging from excessive gossip or drama from their friends to concerns about privacy. According to the survey, 4% of participants cited privacy as an issue, with just 1% saying that they didn't like the intrusive nature of sharing their lives with others. Only 2% of those surveyed said that they prefer to communicate face-to-face, just emphasising how much social behaviour has changed over the past 10 years. Of concern to Facebook, though, will be the reports of decreased usage amongst 18 to 29-year-olds, with 42% of the demographic claiming that the amount of time they spend on the social network site has decreased over the last 12 months. And finally, a bionic man that cost over £500,000 to build has gone on display at the Science Museum in London this week. Named Rex, which is short for Robotic Exoskeleton, the 6'6" humanoid showcases the latest advances in prosthetic technology and was constructed by a team of leading roboticists from Channel 4 documentary How to Build a Bionic Man. Rex has an artificial pancreas, kidney, spleen, trachea and functional blood circulatory system. And even Rich Walker, managing director of the robotics team, Shadow, who built Rex, surprised himself with the project. He said, "We were surprised how many parts of the body can be replaced. There are some vital organs missing, like the stomach, but effectively, 60 to 70% of a human has been rebuilt." The free exhibition runs at the Science Museum until the 11th of March this year, and you can get more information on that if you go to sciencemuseum.org.uk. For all these stories and so much more, just go to the best technology news site on the web. That's guardian.co.uk/technology.
Long before mobile phone technologies and Wi-Fi, most social networking and public broadcasting was done using CB radio or citizens' band radio. Our own Alex Kratosky describes it as a kind of precursor to Facebook and Twitter. And on her travels in the US, Alex decided to investigate this much-loved but long-forgotten technology.
Over the years here at Tech Weekly, we've covered all kinds of social networks as they've come up, and in the case of many, have faded out. MySpace, Friendster, BBM, Bebo, even a little-known network called Facebook, they've all been watched closely from our perch at Guardian Towers. But when I was growing up in the US, the social network that was all the rage was something very different. Like many kids stateside in the 1970s, in my early years, I was fed a diet of the Dukes of Hazzard and cross-country trips on the open road. Add to that cultural crackers like Smokey and the Bandit, and you've got the makings of a romantic fascination with the Citizens Band radio scene. That is the CB radio scene to most folks. Roger that. It was the biggest social network of the decade. I recently relocated back to the U.S. temporarily, and on my way to my final destination, Los Angeles, I decided to take the long road, a surface travel agenda of 8,958 miles of sea and land. What better opportunity to have a closer look at this pre-digital social medium, this proto-online social network, this community of practice, as University of Toronto's Barry Wellman would call it, now that I've returned to the country of my youth. So I dropped a cool $100 at the cash register in the Radio Shack in Stamford, Connecticut, for an own-brand Citizens Band transceiver, a 12-volt DC-powered unit with a bewildering array of buttons across its no-nonsense, tough-stuff black exterior. The device came with a very basic instruction booklet about how to use the squelch and how to tune up and down over its 40 channels. The manual gave no indication of what I might find where. It was, for its price, a very basic unit. But I didn't know that. I was over the moon. I figured that with a flip of a switch, the big skies would open up to a cacophony of banter with Smokey, the Bandit, Luke Duke, and Roscoe P. Coltrane. CB radio arrived on the scene in the mid-1940s and lay dormant until the late 1960s and early 1970s, when it was mostly used by small businesses. CB radios were an open alternative to the closed band of AM and FM. Anyone could apply for a very reasonably priced license or go without one. Like the network of tubes and the internet, it connected people who wanted, who needed, to communicate with lots of folks at the same time across a distance. Now, not too big a distance. Most transceivers have a 5-mile radius, keeping the chat hyper-local. That changes, of course, if you're using it on the road. The number of truckers who use CBs started on its mighty ascent after the U.S. government imposed a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit across the country in response to the 1973 oil crisis. Newspapers called CB radios an especially potent tool in occasionally violent road blockades, convoys, and the protests organized by the surge of independent truckers driving on the 42,500 miles of new interstates that had just been completed. Truckers used the radios to find out where the best place was to get the cheapest petrol, where the closest speed traps were, who had the best blue plate special, and where the cleanest rooms were. And songs like Bill Fry's number one hit Convoy, which landed in the top spot on both the U.S. country and pop charts in 1973 and made it to number two in the U.K., and films like Smokey and the Bandit, the third highest grossing film in 1977 after Star Wars and Close Encounters, helped to cement the CB airwaves as the coolest place to be. By 1976, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission received 500,000 license applications per month, up from 15,000 per month in 1972, and more than a third of CB radio operators on top of that were operating without a license. People had them in their homes, in their cars, in their offices, in their schools. Kids were using their CBs to get help on their homework. Truckers were using it to navigate routes. People were finding one another, and they were falling in love. And there were also powerful CB ears. U.S. First Lady Betty Ford, by all accounts, quite a progressive and fashionable lady, had a notable CB radio habit. First Mama, as she was known, even landed a cover on the fanzine CB Times. The modern-day equivalent is U.S. President Barack Obama's and Vice President Joe Biden's appearances on Reddit's Ask Me Anything. But those are one-offs. Betty was a real regular on those airwaves. Given my background as a social psychologist and internet community researcher, you can see why I was so excited. After all, this little radiophonic experiment was more than just an opportunity to star in my own personal version of Convoy. I know about the web. I study how people online self-organize and self-govern. I study how they signal belonging using specific language codes and by sharing stories. The CB radio scene was another fertile community ground that I could learn about, to wallow in the psychology of belonging, to decipher the lingo, and importantly, to remind myself that what's happening now is interesting, but not necessarily new. And the research bears this out. Anthropologists and sociologists then asked many of the same questions that online researchers are asking now. They looked at how people could develop reputations, even though they were anonymized by their call signs. They watched the fluctuations of trucker allegiances to different truck stops. They studied the evolution of CB slang that truckers developed from Gay Bay to Motor City and pored over the 10 signals, in the same way that now they study the multifaceted meanings of LOL and Roffle. And the same fears that people have about the web now, that it's ruining society, that it's upheaving social norms, that anonymity brings out the worst in people, were exactly the same fears that people had about the CB radio. Specifically, people were terrified of anonymity and how quickly the airwaves turned blue. I should have known it wouldn't be as easy as switching on the thing and announcing myself as Footloose and Limey. The helpful man at the shop, the second shop we visited on our quest to track down the machine, had to root around in the storage room for quite some time before he returned with a dust-covered box that looked like it had been battered by 2 decades of shelf shifting. Despite some early wins on the Cross Bronx Expressway on the way out of Manhattan, when a couple of truckers with pronouncedly colorful language complained at length about the state of traffic and how they'd fix it if they were in charge, the next 2,000 miles, we heard nothing but silence. We tried everything. We read up on the best way to use the CB, which channels to listen to. We reached for it any time we saw more than 2 trucks driving side by side. We even considered getting a kicker, an antenna device that would boost our signal. Nothing. Nothing at all. Until we hit Milan, New Mexico. We stopped for gas somewhere past Albuquerque on Route 20 and checked in on Foursquare. We'd been doing this to keep a record of where we'd been and to see if there was anything interesting on the Explore tab. I was hungry, and Foursquare Explore recommended the Wow Diner in Milan, just a couple of exits down the road. Pulling in, I had a feeling that I'd found one of the last few old-school truck stops in the U.S. After a couple of thousand miles of Flying J's, this was a non-branded haven, and the diner was full of truckers, and the airwaves were full of crazy people. The only thing that pulled me away from the CB radio was my stomach growling. We reluctantly entered the building. President Obama was giving a press conference about gun control when we walked in, and the place was silent, waiting to hear what he had to say. Unsurprisingly, I started talking with the man in the next booth about what was happening on the screen. His name was Alan, and he'd been trucking for 35 years, since he got back from Vietnam. After a while, I felt it was prudent to change the subject. "So," I asked, "what's up with the CB radio? Am I using it wrong?" "Oh, no," he said. "No one was there anymore. He'd taken it out of his cab 8 years before." "But why?" I asked. "Smut," he said. "Smut and bad language. It just wasn't a nice place to be. The trolls had taken over." Nowadays, the CB airwaves are mostly filled with truckers looking for, and I quote, "commercial comfort. Services provided by ladies with handles like Flashlight Andy or Blondie. The ladies are there too, soliciting for work. There are a few places in particular that are famous for it. The truck stop on old Route 22 near Kunzville, Pennsylvania. Exit 18 off Interstate 78 in New Jersey. But it's not just within 5 miles of these locations where you'd hear this kind of business transaction. If you went on there," Alan told me, alluding to my gender, "the air would be blue before you could even finish your first breaker." I was thankful that I'd not made my first foray into CB land then. "I once heard a lady trucker come on and ask where was a good place to eat on Route 20," he continued. "You can imagine what kinds of things she got back. That was the day I took the radio out of my cab. There is no decent conversation on the lines anymore." "A woman's voice," he said, "is immediately assumed to be a hooker." And in this predominantly male-driven industry, they're likely right. CB radio may be the chat roulette of the spectrum, but it's not just the smut that spelled the end for this social network, or indeed the trolls. CB radio simply wasn't flexible enough to grow along with its incredible popularity. There weren't enough channels to cope with the many punters who wanted to be Smokey or the Bandit. The original community left, drowned out by drive-bys and trolls, which wasn't what the erstwhile Smokies or Bandits had signed up for. So they went elsewhere too, to a new technology, where their voices could be heard, where they could participate, and where they could build their own communities. They went to the internet. CB radios are still used by some people for more than blowing off steam, especially in the many parts of the U.S. where there's no data coverage for mobile phones. But its usefulness has run out because neither the people who had invested in it nor the context in which it was such an important technology are there anymore. This means that the nature of the way truckers communicate must also have changed, and this has likely had an effect on the community. Whereas before you could tune into Channel 19 and drop into a conversation with a stranger, now, with a phone, you're using it to chat with just one or a few people. You're usually speaking with someone quite far away. You're more likely to be making existing bonds deeper rather than reaching out. The opportunity to meet new people just for a chat and some banter is low. So I wonder what role meeting face-to-face in places like the WOW Diner has on keeping this community alive. For you see, the drive to connect keeps on trucking. It's what we do as social beings. And it may be useful for today's social network creators to look back and see what's come before they find themselves over and out.
All right, man, I'm going to get on out here. Have a good day, Mr. CC. That's Worldwide Main here, bottom side. You guys cold, it's getting down wet.
And we'll have more reports from the US from Alex Kotowski in the coming months. But that's all we have for you on this week's Tech Weekly. The music featured on this edition is by Martin Heron, otherwise known as Morpion, from the excellent online label IDMF. You can download tracks on the label for free if you go to their site, idmforums.com. But from me, Jemima Kish, and Tech Weekly producers this week, Jason Phipps and George O'Donnell, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.